decide I wanted my body to have a level of immunity to the disease. I read on the internet and heard that there has been an Iranian vaccine coming out. I thought that we can't access foreign vaccines very soon, and that's why I signed up for this study project. This way, we could both help our country's researchers and get the Iranian vaccine.
Asked if the vaccines have been indigenized or made by Iran from scratch, focusing on the Barakat-Sinopharm similarity, Dr. Ruhol Amini answered, reminding us of the nature of different vaccines. He is an MP on the Parliamentary Health Committee with Pasteur Institute on his resume.
There are now many knowledge-based companies and institutes involved producing the vaccines in Iran. This means that several groups are involved in studying and developing mRNA vaccines, which is similar to the Pfizer vaccine. There are several groups involved in making recombinant vaccines. Several others are working on traditional systems, like the attenuated virus design of China's Sinopharm, among which Barakat is the forerunner.
Dr. Hosseini, whom I met at the Eram Center, also contributed.
The attenuated virus vaccine is one of the oldest platforms, and we know much more about its side effects. I always tell my friends who ask what side effects this vaccine can have that the more we know about the side effects of the disease in the long run, the more we know about this vaccine, because the attenuated virus vaccine has been used both traditionally and on an industrial scale about 100 years. But this doesn't mean that we're ignoring tackling the side effects.
The vaccine received an emergency use authorization mid-June and is expected to be rolled out on a large scale before end summer. Its manufacturers say while they are producing 3 million doses per month, they will soon boost production to 11 million doses a month. They also say 12 countries from Asia, South America and Europe wish to buy their Coviran Barakat vaccine. This would be possible once this country's domestic needs are fulfilled. So far, over 5% of Iran's population of under 85 million has been inoculated. The country has recently managed to control a fourth deadly wave of the coronavirus that has so far killed more than 83,000 people. But it's already onto a fifth wave. This I verified with our guest. It's not often we are blessed with lady interviewees, I've been brought to notice. But Dr. Nuri Fahd, infectious disease specialist, is the exception to the rule. Let's savor her input while she's with us at Press TV Studios.
Unfortunately, we are seeing the fifth peak of the disease. We passed four peaks and suffered many fatalities. So far, 3 million people have been infected and we've lost some 80,000 people. We got to a point where we predicted that the infections would ebb in a few months. Our esteemed epidemiologists predicted that the disease would stay dormant until August, where we expected to have a small peak. We thought that, considering the vaccination program, we would experience a small peak and we would be able to open up schools again. But after the outbreak of the Delta variant and other mutations around the world, and because of the international commerce and the activities of the ports in the southern regions of Iran, we were caught by surprise. The Delta and other variants aren't exclusive to one country.
The Pasteur-Covac vaccine, developed by the Pasteur Institute of Iran with Cuba, also received an emergency use license. Health Minister Saeed Namaki said this June the 30th. In its third clinical trial phase, the vaccine has been administered to 44,000 volunteers in Cuba and 25,000 volunteers in Iran. The vaccine's production line can deliver 1 million doses a month in the first trimester, 2 million doses a month in the second trimester, and possibly 3 million doses a month in the third trimester. Also, the Kovpars-Razi vaccine and Fakhra and Spikogen vaccines are likely to be licensed for emergency use and mass-produced by late September. That's if their clinical trial is successful. Iran's vaccine initiative has been viewed suspiciously by a portion of the world for lack of peer-sharing relevant documents. The answer awarded is that Iran is making vaccines for domestic use thus far in response to a biological emergency, and it will be making the vaccine's detailed scientific data public by presenting to the WHO, World Health Organization, for peer reviewing. That's after it completes its third trial phase. Coviran Barakat's developers have claimed it was 93.5% effective among individuals 18 to 75 years of age in its second phase of human trials. With the third phase administering blood tests to check for adverse effects of the vaccine or a welcome increase of antibodies, I asked the man in charge of the vaccine's experimental studies group how he assessed Coviran Barakat now for increasing immunity to the corona disease.
What is being talked about in the media and is being cited as vaccine effectiveness is actually the effectiveness of the antibodies found in the vaccinated people's blood serum in neutralizing the virus. That means a certain amount of active virus from different variants are prepared. Then the vaccinated people would give a blood sample, and the antibodies present in the blood serum are put close to the virus to see how accurately they can neutralize the contagion. They have observed that this neutralization in lab conditions can correlate with immunity from the disease. That's why the 93.5% effectiveness was reported as an overall estimate in three different studies represent how capable the vaccinated people's blood serum have been in neutralizing the virus in the lab conditions.
Iran's vaccine effort being a tad behind countries like the UK with mass inoculation can serve as a strength, given there's still room for adapting vaccines to new strains, such as the deadly strain that originated in India. A live example is the joint product of Iran and Cuba. The Pasteur COVAX vaccine has shown 62% efficiency on new variants of the coronavirus, this Health Minister Namaki said. That would be some 6 times more effective than the British AstraZeneca vaccine, which is just 11% effective against new mutants of the coronavirus, which were identified in South Africa and Brazil.
We predicted a global vaccine shortage. Another point was the sanctions that deprived Iranians of access to the best vaccines. That's a very inhumane move and goes against the principles of human rights. But we had predicted that, and now we see we were right. There is also a scientific and experimental side to all this. As you can see, the United Kingdom, for example, whose population is completely vaccinated and everyone has had their second dose, but they are still grappling with new variants. The same goes for other nations that didn't have our limitations. Therefore, we felt the need to become self-sufficient scientifically and technologically and improve our infrastructure.
19 centers of all sorts are attempting vaccines in Iran. As listed in late June, some others are Razi Kovpars, a vaccine developed by the Razi Vaccine and Serum Research Institute, Fakhravac, made by an organization under Iran's Defense Ministry in honor of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a nuclear scientist assassinated in November by Israel. Iran has clear cause to believe. Also, a vaccine developed by the private biotechnology firm Sinagen. And Iran was to unveil its locally produced version of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine on 26th June. It started its Russian effort in February. As for Osvid-19, that's the domestic vaccine produced by Osva Pharmaceutical Company, which will also be available in early September. And on June the 27th, the IRGC, that's the Revolution Guard Corps, unveiled its own vaccine called Nura.
Eventually, we had to begin domestic production. We made the decision rather late, but we did anyway. There are now 14 companies producing vaccines in Iran, 5 of which are at impressive stages and are doing acceptable work. They are obtaining the necessary permits from the Health Ministry.
The question arises, why is Iran asked to make several vaccines when some developed countries have settled for one even? And why is this country behind itself even in producing fully approved vaccines on a large scale for mass administering?
Naturally, the process of producing vaccines or other medicines takes years, sometimes between 5 to 10 years. Companies invest billions of dollars. Despite all the technological advancements around the world, everyone was caught by surprise over the past year. Many of the world's biggest vaccine producers were surprised. Some of their projects failed, making some of the world's biggest vaccine producers with some strong backgrounds jettison their projects. That's why we need to reduce such risk factors by not putting all our eggs in one basket.
Nominally, basic needs and humanitarian goods are exempt from its sanctions. But banking sanctions mean issues with money transfers and threatening third parties with secondary U.S. sanctions should they deal with Iran. Not everyone dares sell us. So in practice, Iran has suffered from a shortage of imported vaccines and significant gaps between administering their first and second doses. More on sanctions and vaccines coming up, but first a quick media review to see what other outlets are saying. And here is what they say in words. The Tehran Times quotes a kindly word by a neighbor. A Kuwaiti physician calls Iranian coronavirus vaccine scientific breakthrough. A Kuwaiti medical doctor praises Iran's success in producing coronavirus vaccine, saying it marks one of the most important scientific breakthroughs in recent years. The achievement of Iran and Cuba in producing COVID vaccines, which are among the sanctioned countries by the United States and the West, is one of the most important scientific breakthroughs in recent years, Issam al-Saleh told the Tehran Times. It is good news for the peoples of the region who are looking at the global scientific monopoly, he noted. He outlined, despite economic, political, and technological embargoes, Iran is considered one of the 8 countries that have developed infrastructure for this vaccine, which is a glimmer of hope for Muslims and West Asian citizens. It is an achievement we are proud of as people of the region, especially since Iran is a neighboring country to Kuwait and other Arab countries. Reuters talks of the Raisi initiative to combat corona. Iran's Raisi says quick COVID-19 vaccination to top his plans. Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi vowed his government would start rapid COVID-19 vaccinations to help relaunch an economy at the epicenter of the pandemic in the Middle East. The quickest general vaccination will be among our immediate programs from the first day of the government, Raisi said in remarks carried live by state TV. The government of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani has faced criticism for a slow vaccination drive, which officials have blamed on U.S. sanctions hampering efforts to buy foreign vaccines and on delays in deliveries. Iran will focus on using 3 locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba, the current government spokesman Ali Rabi said earlier. Raisi's government takes over in early August. As for the latest COVID deviant, Meh News reads on it, WHO chief says Delta variant of COVID-19 reported in over 98 countries. The Director General of the WHO World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, said in a regular press briefing at WHO headquarters in Geneva that the highly contagious Delta variant, first detected in India, has been reported in over 98 countries and regions. Delta has been detected in at least 98 countries and is spreading quickly in countries with low and high vaccination coverage, he warned. Earlier in Iran, President Hassan Rouhani said that the Delta variant of COVID-19 has entered the country from the eastern and southeastern borders, warning that a fifth wave of the pandemic could be on the way, as the Delta is spreading in the country very quickly. That would be it for this segment, but do stay with us. U.S. and U.N. sanctions as a whole were to be lifted off this country with the signing of the 2015 nuclear deal, or JCPOA. But Trump's USA unilaterally pulled out of that international deal between Iran and the P5+1 in 2018. And it imposed, rather reimposed and reinforced its harshest ever sanctions on this country and threatened others with secondary sanctions. Ensuing unwillingness of financial institutions to process transactions related to Iran, paired with domestic misguided management and so an economic downturn of this country, has led to both inaccessibility and unaffordability of imported vaccines.
India is one of the world's biggest vaccine producers. It has tens of factories which make vaccines by the billions. We had placed an order, paid for it, and received the first batch from India. But the second shipment was blocked inside India after the prosecutor there ruled that the Indian people needed it. This was a country that has friendly relations with us, let alone nations that are openly hostile to us, like the US or some European ones, and others who are upset that Iran has been able to be active in this field. They therefore didn't cooperate with us.
U.S. State Department spokesperson of the time, Morgan Ortegas, in April 2020 repeated the U.S. claim, but with a but. The sanctions do allow the sale of food, agricultural commodities, medicine, and medical devices, provided such transactions do not involve persons designated in connection with Iran's proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or support of international terrorism. Sounds like Iran could have done something about those sanctions and is guilty of having not done so. Dr. Ruhol Amini laughs that comment off.
We tested them on other issues too. They didn't even show mercy to us in selling us food and other vital matters. These are all excuses. The Iranian nation and all the bodies within the country are united. Western countries are making empty promises by saying that if you ignore something, we'll lift the sanctions. They have arrested our academics, like Dr. Soleimani. What was his fault? He's a prominent professor who's thankfully released and is now active in the same field.
The Iranian vaccine effort is not just due to sanctions. It's also a cultural tendency and a matter of distrust for some foreign brands. Iran has been making vaccines anyway, while some regional states have been happy to import and administer vaccines. Arab leaders are known to have a consumerist attitude, but in addition to countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, Turkey is well on its way to full vaccination. However, there are known to have been issues and problems with the types of vaccine and their effectiveness. Novavax and AstraZeneca are good examples, as the UAE and Bahrain are reportedly having various issues with these two. Our Barakat volunteers seemed pretty okay as I spoke to them of how they felt immediately after their jabs.
Some of us had symptoms after we took the vaccine, such as headaches, body aches, and fever. Well, we were hoping to have received the main vaccine because here they announced that those who had the symptoms were really vaccinated. When I received the first dose, my body was sore for a couple of days, especially near where I was injected. I had symptoms like pain, runny nose, and dizziness. They controlled all the symptoms here, so I didn't run into any problems. I can say it didn't take 2 days before the symptoms went away.
One of the reasons for Iran setting about manufacturing local jabs is that authorities distrust brands made by countries such as the US and UK, Pfizer and Moderna to be specific. The leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, actually said if Pfizer were that good, the death toll in America wouldn't have hit 4,000 a day. Also, he expressed concerns that said countries might want to use other populations, such as Iranians, as guinea pigs. They often want to test these vaccines on people in other countries to check their effectiveness, he said, also adding that he was not very optimistic about the French vaccine either. The leader, in support of Iran's domestic vaccine effort, received the first dose of Coviran Barakat on the 26th of June, as captured by the media to prove that vaccine's reliability. Hence Iran's preference. First for a homegrown vaccine, second for a joint product by a joint effort with countries like Cuba and Russia, and third for importing foreign makes. U.S. sanctions have caused money transfer issues, which have caused imports to lag behind, or which have caused a significant gap between administering first and second doses of foreign vaccines. But Iran has still fairly effortlessly imported significant consignments of vaccines from China, Korea, India, and Russia, and through the global initiative COVAX under the WHO, World Health Organization.
There is a COVAX basket. The World Health Organization, in collaboration with the European Union and France, UNICEF and charitable organizations, came together to create a vaccine basket to donate jabs to vaccinate medical personnel and the vulnerable people around the world for free. But the basket is empty right now, since it was meant to be recharged by South Korean-made AstraZeneca vaccines, which are now being produced in India due to its favorable infrastructure. Even if the COVAX basket is recharged, countries that want to solely rely on the program can only vaccinate 20% of their population. But what about the other 80%?
There has been a halt or hiccup in the incoming flow finally, however, because those countries are also struggling with new challenges arising with a persistent, ever-mutating coronavirus. The ravages of corona are undeniable, and handling the disease may have not been consistent. But on the upside, the outbreak appears to have gotten the government to increase the number of hospital beds and pay more attention to the health sector in Iran.
Regardless of what's happened and the difficult circumstances that have saddened all of us, like you and me, what we've been doing will definitely prove worthwhile and an impressive achievement in the long run. God willing, by the time we've passed all the problems that me, you, our families, and the great family of Iran have endured, we will have created capacities in the country that wouldn't have been possible or would have taken much more time to do under normal conditions.
That's it for today, but of course it's an ongoing story, so do join us again in the coming weeks at the same times. Till next week, bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
People under the age of 65 living in the most deprived areas of the United Kingdom were more than 3.7 times more likely to die with COVID than people in the richest areas. We have prepared for you an article authored by Patrick Butler under the heading, COVID death risk almost 4 times higher for poorest in England. Inquiry into the health impact of the coronavirus pandemic has found that chances of dying from COVID-19 were nearly 4 times higher for adults of working age in England's poorest areas than for those in the wealthiest places. The 9-month inquiry by the Health Foundation charity said a decade of widening health inequalities and cuts to public services had frayed the nation's health and contributed to the United Kingdom's disproportionately high COVID death toll compared with similar countries. It called for urgent action to reduce health differences and urged significant public investment in the National Health Service, the NHS, in jobs, housing, education, communities and social security. It warned there must be no reboot of austerity policies of the past decade as the United Kingdom prepared to move out of the pandemic. Joe Bibby, the Foundation's Director of Health, said, "We may have to learn to live with COVID-19, but we don't have to live with its unequal impact." She added, "We cannot afford to make the same mistake twice." The report echoes many of the findings of the public health expert Sir Michael Marmot's report into COVID health inequalities in Greater Manchester, published recently, and reflects increasing concerns over the scale and focus of the government's plans for the United Kingdom's long-term recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. The chair of the inquiry, Dame Claire Moriarty, said, we need to aim for a recovery that builds economic and social resilience, with levelling up not limited to geographical areas of disadvantage, but that addresses the needs of groups who have experienced the most damaging impacts of the pandemic. In her introduction to the report, Dame Claire Moriarty wrote, "The legacy of the pandemic is all around us, in unmet health need, mental health problems, gaps in educational attainment, loss of employment, and financial insecurity. If we are to avoid these becoming long-term scars, it's time to confront our choices about how we value people." There have been more than 150,000 excess deaths in the United Kingdom during the pandemic. The inquiry said the single biggest factor in the spread of COVID in the United Kingdom was the timing of lockdowns and the stringency of restrictions. The report added, "Once the virus had spread, the extent to which different groups were affected reflected variations in underlying health and socio-economic factors that increase risk of exposure and worse outcomes." The inquiry found high COVID death rates in the poorest areas were driven in part by poor pre-existing health problems. People aged 50 to 69 in the 10% most deprived neighbourhoods of the United Kingdom were more than twice as likely to have long-term conditions that put them at higher risk, such as diabetes and chronic lung conditions. Jobs and occupations including caring, manufacturing and leisure industry also increased the risk of exposure to the virus, as did poor housing conditions. Going into the pandemic, overcrowding in private and social rented housing in England was at its highest recorded level. As well as being highest in deprived areas, COVID mortality rates were higher for certain groups, such as care home residents, disabled people, and ethnic minority communities. Young people suffered disproportionately high levels of mental illness. The inquiry said this was a landmark opportunity to rebuild public services and reduce widening health inequalities and declining life expectancy across the United Kingdom. The report added, "A recovery that puts increasing and fair opportunities for good health as a priority will need action to deal with the conditions that lead to poor health in the first place." The inquiry noted adequate income, good quality jobs and housing were necessary ingredients for good health. The report added, "The decline in improvement in health life expectancy partly reflects the erosion of these social conditions in the United Kingdom in the decade preceding the coronavirus pandemic, affecting certain groups to a greater extent." The inquiry said the pandemic had laid bare the weaknesses of policy decisions made after the 2008 financial crash to drastically reduce public spending. This meant when COVID struck, public services were in a weakened state, and the health and financial resilience of many poorer households had been drastically weakened. It said the widening of health inequalities in the United Kingdom over the past decade had exposed the United Kingdom for a high death toll and reduced people's ability to deal with the subsequent economic shock. Meanwhile, a new report from the King's Fund warns obesity is fast becoming a disease of England's poorest people, putting them at higher risk of dying from the biggest killer diseases. The think tank says there is a stark and widening gap between the number of people from deprived families who are dangerously overweight and those from better-off backgrounds, and the difference is particularly pronounced amongst women. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson had identified tackling obesity as a key objective after realizing how dangerous it can be when he was hospitalized last year with COVID. Sir Simon Stevens, the head of the National Health Service England, has sounded the alarm about rising obesity, describing it as the new smoking for its potential to harm public health. Richard Murray, the King Fund's chief executive, said, "Obesity is increasingly a disease of the poorest people and is damaging the life chances of children in the poorest parts of England, and increasingly as they go into adulthood," adding, "The failure to grip the growing obesity crisis in poor parts of England will condemn people to a higher chance of diabetes, heart disease and some forms of cancer. It will inflict an increasing burden on them as individuals and on the National Health Service." The think tank highlights a significant increase in obesity in the most deprived communities in England in recent years, leading to a widening gap between the poor and affluent areas. For example, the gap in rates of obesity amongst women in the most and least deprived areas grew from 11% in 2014 to 17% in 2020. Data from the National Child Measurement Programme shows the gap has worsened among children too. The difference in obesity rates between the poorest and richest 10 and 11-year-olds in primary schools increased from 8% in 2006-2007 to 13% in 2019-2020. Richard Murray, the King Fund's chief executive, said this underlines the need for government to tackle deep and widening inequalities, which the pandemic has exposed as part of its declared aims of levelling up and building back better after COVID, and efforts to reduce obesity in poor areas will be a key test. A government spokesperson said, "We're absolutely committed to levelling up health inequalities across the country as part of our recovery from COVID-19. Through our obesity strategy and the recently announced ban on advertising of unhealthy foods, we're taking concrete steps to get the nation fit and healthy and protect the long-term health of our children."
Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Moscow says the Jabhat al-Nusra terrorist group, along with members from other terrorist groups, are involved in this. Now, the chemicals, Moscow says, are being stockpiled in Idlib province in the northern de-escalation zone. The terrorists plan to use these chemicals against the people and then blame the Syrian government, with the help of what Moscow calls a pseudo-humanitarian group, the White Helmets, who it says is an arm of the terrorists. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest that's taking place in Syria. Well, we're going to start it off by crossing over to Damascus and getting the latest from Mohammed Ali. Mohammed Ali, tell me what you have on this story, the latest information.
Yes, according to Deputy Chief of the Russian Center for Reconciliation based at Hmeymim Air Base in Syria, Vadim Kolet, he said that they received information that terrorists of the al-Nusra Front are planning for a provocation in the de-escalation zone of Idlib by carrying out a false flag chemical attack, and then they plan to accuse and blame the Syrian army for carrying out such a false flag chemical attack. Now, according to Kolet, he said that terrorists of the al-Nusra Front, accompanied by members of the so-called White Helmets, transported 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area called Harem in Idlib over there in order to carry out this false flag chemical attack in the southern part of the Al-Zawiya Mountain, also in the de-escalation zone of Idlib, and then accused the Syrian army for such an attack. Of course, this is not the first time that Russia warns of such an attempt that terrorists are planning, of the al-Nusra Front, of course, in Idlib. And according to many analysts, every time terrorists of the al-Nusra Front feel or know that the Syrian army and its allies are preparing for an offensive to squash them in Idlib, they actually attempt to carry out such a pulse-like chemical attack because they want to invite some kind of foreign intervention or international pressure that would lead to perhaps stopping such a military operation. Finally, previously, we used to see in Syria exit deals in which terrorists get out via buses and then the government controls that area, terrorists go to Idlib. But now, terrorists have no other place to go after Idlib, so they know that they're going to be killed over there.
All right, thank you so much, Muhammad Ali, for giving us the update on the latest situation taking place there. I'm going to cross over now to Budapest. Welcome my next guest, George Zamudli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, and author of Bombs for Peace. Thank you so much for being with us. Are you surprised? I mean, we're seeing the same MO being replayed time and time again. Your assessment of this, are you surprised at this repeat of this scenario?
No, not surprised in the slightest. As you say, we had this same scenario in 2017 and in 2018, and the Trump administration took the bait and launched bombings attacks. We know for certain that both of them were absolutely fake. The Syrian government was not responsible for the chemical weapons attack, and there is no reason, there was never any reason anymore that there was a reason in 2013 in Ghouta for the Syrian government to use chemical weapons when essentially it has won the war. So therefore, the only purpose of creating these incidents is to justify a U.S. Military intervention, a U.S. attacks against the Syrian government. And I'm afraid that it's quite possible that this will happen. We've already seen that the Biden administration has twice bombed Syria. And I would fully expect them if such a situation occurred again, that the Biden administration would take the bait and bomb Syrian government positions.
Well, let me turn to London. Welcome my next guest to Spotlight, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and analyst, author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Return of Russia to World Politics. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, I want to look at Moscow has blamed the terrorist group's foreign handlers for these acts. Let's talk about, in your perspective, your analysis of all of this, the biggest supporters of the terror and instability still in Syria are which players?
Well, there's no question about it that the terrorists in Syria, specifically Al-Qaeda and ISIS, would not have been the potent force that they once were during the Syrian conflict without the assistance of major powers in the world. And those major powers are many, but in particular, they are as follows: America, Britain, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. The terrorists, for a number of years during the Syrian conflict, advanced deeply into Syrian territory, conquering a number of Syrian cities, but in particular, conquering many Syrian towns, many Syrian villages. And the Syrian armed forces, which have been for decades now one of the best trained, one of the best equipped, and one of the best led in the Middle East, were faced with a deadly challenge from those terrorist groups. Therefore, it is simply inconceivable that those terrorist groups had been able to advance and deliver some very grievous blows to the Syrian army without the assistance of first-rate powers in the world. So, as I said moments ago, without the support of major powers in the world, and I would say most importantly of all, America and Britain, ISIS and Al-Qaeda would never have been the potent force that they once were in the Syrian conflict. And secondly, they never would have been able to inflict the grievous blows on the Syrian army that they once did. And they would never have been able to occupy the amount of Syrian territory that they once did.
Okay, well, George, now, there was a chemical attack in Douma, Damascus suburb, an rebel-held area in 2018. The United States and the United Kingdom blamed the Syrian government for the attack and initiated airstrikes against government targets. Now, the Organization of Prohibited Chemical Weapons investigated, and as you know, there was much controversy internally with disagreements with the inspectors and even reports of cover-up. I want to talk about the importance of all this, the role the OPCW is playing actually in perhaps helping the terrorists, because we saw even some of the inspectors trying to come out and say they disagreed with the report, but basically they were shut down.
Yes, you've summarized it perfectly. That's exactly what happened. The actual inspectors who went to Douma did not find any evidence of the use of chemical weapons, and they wrote that in their report. But of course, this was not acceptable to the bureaucracy of OPCW that relies on the United States and the United Kingdom and the rest of them. And so they rewrote the report, but essentially completely falsifying the findings of the actual inspectors, the actual experts. So that's why there is no way that, if there is a chemical weapons attack, and the OPCW again sends in their inspectors, there's absolutely no reason why we should believe in any way anything that the OPCW finds. And you're absolutely right. They do serve as the enablers of the terrorists because they're there then to scream, oh, yeah, yeah, Syria used these terrible chemical weapons, and therefore then the United States and the United Kingdom can then triumphantly say, well, we have no choice but to act. So I think this is it's a great danger. But there is also a drumbeat that's going on right now. As you probably know, there was a debate at the United Nations Security Council about opening up additional border crossings to get, quote, humanitarian aid, unquote, into Idlib. So you can see that there is a kind of Western propaganda drumbeat taking place right now of Idlib, and that's why I think this is a very dangerous situation.
Well, Marcus, what about that? I mean, George just talked about this, the discussion in the United Nations about opening, as he said, so-called humanitarian corridor. Now, I want to talk about the role of these so-called international organizations and what has been happening in Syria. I mean, it seems as if what they have been doing is basically in support of these neoliberal regimes instead of being actually a player to try to control the situation and de-escalate. Your take.
Well, whilst the creation of the United Nations was an honorable and admirable one, the problem is not the United Nations per se. The problem lies with certain members of the United Nations who abuse bodies of the United Nations and mechanisms of the United Nations. And again, the two principal offenders are America and Britain. Washington and London use their immense global clout, both political, economic, military, and cultural clout, to penetrate bodies of the United Nations in order to use them as tools of Western foreign policy objectives. So I do not believe that there is a problem per se with the United Nations. The problem, as I said moments ago, lies with certain powerful countries in the world who abuse their membership of the UN to pursue their foreign policy objectives. And in the case of Syria, we see how Washington and London have unashamedly used the United Nations to provide cover for the terrorists in Syria, both Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The way in which the Americans and the British have used the United Nations to portray the so-called freedom fighters in Syria is really quite sickening, and it goes to show once again how the old maxim is correct: might is right. Because the Americans and the British know very well whom they are supporting in Syria. They know that the groups they are supporting are Wahhabist groups, who are essentially, ideologically, the same people who carried out the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington in 2001, and in London in 2005 and in 2017, and in Bali and so on and so on.
Okay.
But of course, those terrorist groups are potent weapons of the Americans and the British, and they have used them in many conflicts, not just the Syrian one, but the Bosnian one too.
George, your take on what Marcus has said, and if you agree with what he's saying, I mean, what exactly does that mean? The same terrorist and that has caused havoc in various Western cities is the same group that then these same capitals, London and Washington, are actually supporting in Syria. So what is it that the United States and the United Kingdom, what's the goal? What are they really after?
Well, the goal is regime change. These terrorists, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, are very useful to effect regime change. I mean, either they can wage a war ad infinitum, they can just debilitate a country and drain them, as it looked like it would happen in Syria before Russia made its very significant intervention in the fall of 2015, which arrested the progress of these jihadi terrorists. So either that or via these staged incidents and therefore, which again then justify Western intervention. But of course, the longer these wars continue, then the longer or the greater the imperative within the Western capitals to continually apply further and further pressure against, for example, in this case, the Syrian government via sanctions. Because, of course, the Syrian government gets blamed for the war, gets blamed for the atrocities, gets blamed for everything that's gone wrong in Syria, and so therefore that serves to justify the horrific sanctions regime imposed by the United States and the European Union. And Marcus is absolutely right. There's no secret that the United States used ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And we have John Kerry's confession on this score. We have Joe Biden's confession on this score. They're open about it. They used ISIS in order to topple Bashar al-Assad. They failed. They also used ISIS to effect a regime change in Iraq, because the person was then prime minister. The Americans didn't care for him. So that's what happened. And Marcus is right. This was they did this same thing in Bosnia, mm-hmm. and which then served. Again, there were all these sudden atrocities, which always happened in the same place. And particularly at crucial moments in the war,
okay.
and then which
okay.
comes of the justification for NATO military intervention.
Well, Marcus, now, Russia's previously talked about the role of the white helmets, this so-called, as they're talking about, presenting themselves as a humanitarian group, but Russia's talked about them serving, actually, the terrorist cells in Syria. I want to talk about the role of the white helmets in this, and how they're getting away with really not even being condemned, not even being examined by the so-called mainstream media. Your take on this?
British state propaganda is formidable, and in my opinion, it is the foremost propaganda outlet in the world, and I would also say in recent times. And the White Helmets is just one example of that. The White Helmets, far from being a humanitarian organization, is nothing more than a propaganda outfit created and financed by the British state, not Britain, by the British state. The two are very different entities. Created and financed by the British state to depict the Syrian government in the most awful of manners, as a justification for supporting the so-called freedom fighters in Syria and as a justification for the economic sanctions imposed by America and the European Union on the Syrian government. Now, the White Helmets, the creation of the White Helmets, has been exceedingly successful in that it has convinced a great many people, in particular in the Western world, that this organization is a humanitarian one. However, it is quite easy to punch holes and large holes in the image which is projected by London of the White Helmets. So, for instance, why is it that the White Helmets, who purport to be a humanitarian organization serving the Syrian people, only operate in territories controlled by either ISIS or Al-Qaeda? If they were an organization serving humanitarian purposes in Syria, then they would be all over Syria. They would be in parts controlled by the Syrian government and in parts controlled by ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But they never have been in areas controlled by the Syrian government. So it is a very simple situation in which we find that the White Helmet is but a tool of the British state to further the objective of London and Washington in Syria, namely the overthrow of the Syrian government, the destruction of the Syrian state, the creation of a new Syrian state, which would be subservient to the West and compliant with Israel.
All right. Well, George, really quickly, 30 seconds. Where do you see this going? What is it going to take to actually bring peace to Syria again and these Western regimes to accept their losses? We've just seen the Syrian people vote in a presidential election. What is it going to take to end the chaos there?
Well, you may not like the answer. My own feeling is that the only way that you can bring about peace in Syria is if the Syrian government, with the assistance of the Russians, makes the final move for Idlib and bring the Idlib under Syrian government control and finally rid the country of this Al-Qaeda.
Okay, and on that note, I have to thank you both. So sorry, we're out of time. I appreciate you both being with us. Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and analyst. Author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Rise of Russia to World Politics, out of London. And George Samutli, senior research fellow, Global Policy Institute, author, Bombs for Peace, out of Budapest.